All right. Thank you for joining me for this is the 5th anniversary of We Are Movies, this episode.
Does that mean I've been on 6 times?
This is your 6th time on. All right. Yeah, because you're on the very first episode. And actually, I think this is the first time since that first episode that we've recorded in person.
That's true.
Actually, it's all been Zoom.
You kind of had to twist my arm a little bit.
I did have to twist your
arm. I actually prefer the Zoom element, but this is fun too. And
right.
It's good to see you, and it's good to be in your movie shrine of a home.
Right, yeah, the movie shrine, which is, it's amazing that when I was dating, this is a thing that girls would walk past and still be okay with, you know.
That was like your proof that it was, that this one was okay.
Yes,
if they accepted that they walk in and see. Do you even know how many?
How many Blu-rays are next to us? Gosh, I'm bad with estimates.
Yeah, but I would be curious.
Oh, 500 is a shot in the dark.
Far more than anyone your age should have.
Far more than anyone my age should have. Yeah, yes. Nobody. I'm probably the only 25-year-old in existence who has this collection of Bud Bedeker westerns starring Montgomery Clift. My thing for that will be like, oh, I got to pick this up, then I'll have something to bring to my grandpa's house and
there you
bond
go.
Over. For me, it was always like first couple dates, I go meet them somewhere, I pick them up, they don't see this place. And then once I think they're ready for the movie wall, then they can step in. But speaking of the movie wall, obviously, you know, we were just talking off mic, my obsession with movies is pretty vast. It's kind of, you know, I love all genres and subgenres and everything and every time period. Now, you've said many times before, you know, you have select tastes, but I think somebody could easily be fooled into thinking you are, and I don't know if you consider yourself this, a cinephile. And that's because, and I'll tell you why, I think it's because whatever you are into, you go all in on.
Oh,
and
that's
You have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything that you do really like. So when you do talk about your favorite films, it's more than the average person knows about their own favorite films.
That is very accurate. If you want to use the term cinephile to describe that, that's fine.
Sure. Part-time cinephile.
But that is, well, and it's not just movies.
Right.
When I get interested in a subject, I go all in.
Yeah.
And it is diverse. I mean, everything from the game show host Bill Cullen.
Yep.
To Meredith Willson and the Music Man. Yeah. I have ridiculously specific collection of Meredith Willson memorabilia. I mean, that's how ridiculous. So yeah, if I really get into a movie, I will go all in.
Yeah.
And I will learn everything I can about it. Now, to be fair, I also study before I'm going to be on your show.
Right.
So that it's not like I'm pulling this stuff out from years gone by.
Right.
I did my homework.
Which we should say for the audience was the reason you were hesitant about not doing Zoom, because you didn't have the resources directly in front of you.
I can have my stuff on one side of the screen and you on the other, and it works out well. So
right.
Now we're winging it.
We are winging it.
Let the record show I have nothing in front of me.
Yeah, no, there's no notes. I'm impressed there's no notes. I thought you'd have.
Well, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. But, so for the 5th anniversary, we've always, I think every year we always lock down what the next one's going to be, and then it always changes right before it happens. We never know it's
going to
be,
so
you know, Kelly's
to
Heroes. I think the original plan was 5th anniversary would be Citizen Kane.
Sure.
But we'll save that for 10.
All right. That's fine. That's
yeah,
fine.
You'll radio in from Palm Springs.
I don't think I'm sophisticated enough to talk intelligently about Citizen
that
Kane.
That one's daunting.
That is a tough
thing. I don't even know if I definitely don't think I'm sophisticated enough to talk about. I was like, I need time to listen to the Ebert commentary.
What I was going to say. My favorite thing about my DVD, not Blu-ray, my DVD of Citizen Kane is listening to, watching it with Roger Ebert.
Right.
Because that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's one of my absolute favorite commentaries.
I remember you talked to me, when I was in high school, we talked about that because we were recording a commentary for the Blu-ray DVD release of the play that I had co-directed.
Feet under.
That was 3 feet under with Holden and Megan. And we got talking about commentaries, and you said the best audio commentary of all time is Roger Ebert for Citizen
Kane. Absolutely,
And you said it started off with, I'm Roger Ebert, and today we're going to watch Citizen Kane.
we're going to watch Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I want to do.
I do. I love that. Yeah. So the movie we didn't end up choosing is actually a movie that we have history with, which is The Last of Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie I first saw it when I was in high school. You loaned me the DVD copy that you have of this. again.
I do not remember that specific thing. I know I would have recommended it to you, but yes. I didn't realize that you actually watched my DVD.
You gave me the DVD. I remember that blatantly, because I remember it was a weirdly packaged DVD. It was kind of different than others.
Warner Brothers would release DVDs on demand for the longest time.
Oh.
They would have they movies that weren't famous enough to warrant a print run, you could order them.
Yeah.
And they would burn, much like if you ordered a copy of 3 Feet Under from Okemos High School, I would burn you a copy of
right.
that. Warner Brothers would do that with their less popular movies. You would place an order, and they would burn that copy for you and send you that movie.
Wow.
And that's why it would look a little different.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, and that's probably also why, I mean, that would, economically, I guess it makes sense, because you don't want to be, you know, backlogged with
you don't
copies
make,
of Last of Sheila.
to churn them out professionally, to make it make economic sense, there's got to be some number in
yeah.
the thousands.
Yeah.
And if a movie's not going to sell in the thousands, then that doesn't make economic sense.
Right, right.
I don't know if they still do that or not in this era when the discs themselves are not necessarily in favor. But for the longest time, that's how you got a copy of something like The Last of Sheila.
Well, nowadays, and if you look at the shelf next to me, there's a big enough number of weirdos like me that are collectors that I do think they're able to depend on them,
sure.
on us, I guess.
And you figure out how to make the economics of it work.
Yeah, you do. I remember watching the movie, and you had sold it to me. It's a whodunit. And the big selling point for you that I remember you telling me right off the bat is that the behind the scenes people is strange, that it's unusual, and that it's the script is co-written by Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim.
Right.
Which is an eclectic pair of guys, first of all, neither of whom is really known as a screenwriter.
Right, exactly. And the less you know about them, the less sense it makes.
Right, right.
Because you think, for anybody who knows Stephen Sondheim, you know him as the guy who wrote the musicals.
Right.
And you know Anthony Perkins, basically, because he was the guy from Psycho.
Right.
And let's face it, that's the only reason you know Anthony Perkins,
right.
is he was the guy from Psycho.
A great acclaimed actor, but to today's generation, you probably only
exactly.
know him as
I'm
Norman
not saying
Bates.
You don't know anything
right,
else
right.
besides Psycho.
In pop culture, he's
right.
Norman Bates.
So the Psycho guy and the musicals guy wrote a mystery together, a complicated, convoluted puzzle of a mystery together.
Yeah.
Now, come to find out, if the deeper you go, they our puzzle guys, especially Sondheim, was a puzzle guy all along. He compares writing a perfect lyric to writing a perfect puzzle.
Interesting.
And would love to create these scavenger hunts with his famous friends.
Yeah.
He and Perkins would create these puzzles very much like the kind of thing that happens in this movie. And his famous friends would go all over New York City finding the clues and figuring out what they meant and it was a big deal in that little circle. One of the people who participated in that game was Herbert Ross.
Oh,
who ended
the director.
Up directing the film. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Herbert Ross is one of those guys. I was looking him up today because I didn't really know him by name. And he is, I think, the definition of what we call a journeyman in terms of directors.
You know, I was hoping we could talk about Herbert Ross a little bit, because it kind of surprises me that you're not familiar with the name, but on the other hand, it's not. I mean,
well, I was familiar with his filmography.
Your vast knowledge, you know, there's not going to be a retrospective
right.
of Herbert Ross movies.
Right.
But good golly, you look at what he did,
yeah.
and some of them were huge. I picture him as the Neil Simon guy, and a lot of the stuff that he did were the movie versions of Neil Simon plays. He also directed some Neil Simon plays, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, but then stuff you just
Footloose.
Really?
Footloose.
Steel Magnolias, really?
Yeah.
Which was like long after his heyday,
right?
But he had massive, massive hits, and there's a lot of stylish stuff going on in The Last of Sheila.
There is.
But it's awfully hard to say he had a distinctive style.
Right. Well, and it's, I think, something that bugs me sometimes with, you know, entry-level film student brain is always that you write off anybody who's not an auteur.
Yes.
You know? If they don't have a distinctive style, they're not worth your attention. And I think that takes out a lot of great directors.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of people that have made amazing films and adapted so well, and were just working in the system. You know, it's like, are you gonna forget capitalism? Are you gonna forget that it's hard to make a living in life? And
absolutely,
you know, and always do what you want to do. And I mean, the fact that to do something like The Last of Sheila and also Footloose. And Footloose is a classic, you know, it's like, it still takes talent.
And this is a guy who worked steady. It wasn't like he made a film every 5 years. He was churning them out. And, you know, not everything worked, but they all were meaningful studio pictures. They were in the system. It wasn't like he couldn't get financing or something. He was very much a part of the Hollywood scene,
right?
Which, of course, the other thing about this great murder mystery, it's also a great send-up of the Hollywood scene.
Yes, I wanted to mention that because it's one of the aspects of what's, and I think I just rewatched it yesterday, and it is a movie that I don't think I fully appreciated. I liked it at the time, and I was enthralled by it, and I was entertained by it. I only now have, like, really noticed how clever the screenplay is inside, beyond the mystery itself. Because I think early on I was disappointed, where I was like, well, the murder doesn't happen until an hour in. you know, like, what am I doing? And then watching it this time, kind of knowing what was coming, I was appreciating every part of the really methodical script by Sondheim and Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to first tell you, so my reaction to it is kind of, it comes from, and the movie knowingly is part of a long-running genre of the whodunit.
Sure.
And my knowledge of the whodunit came from, originally it came from comedy. It came from, speaking of Neil Simon, Murder by Death was one of my favorite movies as a kid.
It's terrific. I loved Murder by Death.
And I
wouldn't be surprised that Herbert Ross directed that. I'm not sure.
I don't think he did.
But it wouldn't have surprised me if he had.
Right, right. And so comedies like that, or Clue the movie. There was an episode of Get Smart that I was obsessed with as a kid. Because I used to watch Get Smart. And it was...
Now, when you say as a kid, you're not talking first run.
No. Yeah. I'm talking, I had the box set DVDs.
Sure, of course of Get Smart. You did.
There was an episode where it was an Agatha Christie parody, and they had a crude parody of Charlie Chan, who's the
probably
of a white guy playing an Asian detective. But I remember watching that, and it's even through the comedies I was watching, I was really interested in the setup and kind of all the tropes of a whodunit. And then, you know, I eventually read Agatha Christie and watched a lot of those movies. But something that makes Last of Sheila stand out is it's one of the few, especially at the time, that was just an original film. It wasn't based on a novel or anything like that.
Exactly. So an audience is going in truly not knowing what's going to happen.
Yes. Yeah. And you mentioned the aspect of the parlor games, which I read a little bit about today. And that really fascinated me, because this the crux of the story is James Coburn plays, is he a producer?
He's a producer, an imperious producer. He's wildly successful.
Yes. Yeah. And so he's this producer named Clinton Green, and he's putting together a rich people party of, you know, where they get to do a fake mystery on a yacht. And this was the type of thing that I was like, this is a thing only rich people only do in movies, was something I always thought, you know, these games. And then I was reading, like, yeah, Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins, this was something they would do.
Necessarily on a yacht in the Mediterranean.
Right.
But they would do it with their friends.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was a massive undertaking. It was a big, big deal.
Yes. And that, you know, semi-autobiographical aspect is really interesting, on top of the fact that by making the movie, all the characters are Hollywood people, which is obviously Perkins and Sondheim writing what they know.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, it's they're giving permission for characters to treat this in a way as though it is a fun mystery, like it's a movie. There's a line where James Mason says, he says, like, oh, well, there's been a murder, now we got to find the killer. Isn't that how it goes? Or something like that. They're thinking about movies that exist, because they're thinking like they're in a movie sometimes. And that's something that occurred to me this time that I really loved. But I'm curious, before we much deeper into it. What was your first experience with this movie? Do you remember?
Yeah, very much. As I've said in past shows, all throughout the 80s, I worked in video stores. And the box caught my eye. Mm. Literally, I can still visualize. It was Warner Brothers had oversized VHS cases that they were called clamshell because if you opened it up, it looked like a clam.
Yes.
Great big cases that would hold a full size VHS cassette. And I can still picture that green Warner Brothers packaging with that poster.
It's like a question mark with all the actors on it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the boat. It, on a weird personal note, and I hadn't thought about this in forever. When I was in college, I had a girlfriend named Sheila.
Oh.
How about that?
Yeah, yeah.
So that caught my eye. This was long after we had broken up. Well, long after she had broken up with me, and I was heartbroken. Oh, my goodness. So I was amused by that part of it. And even though I didn't really start going to the movies until the late 70s, I was very much aware of who actors were.
Mm-hmm.
And the cast is, what a great 70s yes. cast.
That was the first thing that stuck out to me.
It
when
is very much a 70s cast.
Yeah.
All more or less equal, certainly equal enough that they're billed in alphabetical order.
Mm-hmm.
And it just looked like it would be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. To briefly run down my understanding of the cast at the time when I saw this, I knew James Coburn. Because I love Westerns. I love The Great Escape is one of my favorite films of all the sure. of all time, you know. And
I think you could make the case he was the star among stars of that seven.
Yes.
Of that group of seven.
And you can tell by the role they give him.
Right, right.
He's the guy.
He is the one, even though everybody gets equal billing, and you can make an argument that there are, well, we'll get to the others, but
right.
He's definitely number one on the pecking list.
Right, and that almost kind of goes with the tradition of whodunits, where the murderee is the most famous actor sometimes.
Sometimes.
Like, I've seen that in multiple occasions where they intentionally... It's almost like it's a cliche in of itself now that it's the most famous actor will die in the first reel.
The hilarious send-up of that was every episode of Police Squad.
Right, where they would die in the opening. Speaking
special
of Zucker,
guest star William Shatner, and right. he's gunned down in the opening credits.
Yes, yeah. yeah. And then...
By the way, we should mention... the nature of this program, I would imagine, at least in part, is to encourage people to go out and watch these movies.
Yes.
This is a mystery. We don't want to give a whole lot away
right.
about what happens.
Do we want to avoid what happens?
I don't know. It's up to you. It's your show.
I would say when we get to that point, we'll offer a warning.
Oh, well, okay. Fair enough.
We'll just
fair
say, enough. Warning, we're going to spoil yes. it. It's not going to happen quite yet, but I'll make sure. I'll stay on top of it. But I guess we've already spoiled it.
No, I guess it's fair.
James Coburn does get murdered.
But that's pretty much, it's one of those things where you're watching the movie and you're watching the movie and they're playing the game and they're all having fun. And then somebody, okay, yeah, their host is murdered.
Right.
And, oh, that's right. This is a murder mystery. This,
right.
This is what the movie is about. And I guess it's okay that we tell people that, yes, James Coburn dies about halfway through.
He does. As for the suspect slash detective characters, I obviously was familiar with Raquel Welch. Speaking of the Naked Gun films, she's in Naked Gun 33 and a third.
Uh-huh.
I knew her from that, but I knew her from Haney Calder, which is a Western, and some things like that. Ian McShane is still an active actor today. He's in the John Wick movies.
Relatively young at the time.
Yeah.
Again, if you got a pecking order going, he was at the lower end of that
right.
group at the time.
The newcomer type. Mm-hmm. And then James Mason at this point is sort of legend. You
right.
know, he'd had a big career in the 50s. I knew him from Bigger Than Life, the Nicholas Ray movie. And then prominently, his name is, Richard Benjamin. I had only known from a movie, of speaking of parodies, a horror comedy called Saturday the 14th. Have you ever heard of this?
I have heard of it. I would not necessarily have known that Richard Benjamin was in it.
He's the lead. He's the
okay.
father.
All right.
And he gives a hilarious performance that almost feels like he either didn't care or he cared a lot. It's really difficult to tell. But yeah, that was all I would have been exposed to at the time. But yeah, so the cast is incredible.
Joan Hackett.
Joan Hackett.
Died way too young.
Yeah.
She was up and coming star. Richard Benjamin was the hot young actor at the time. Mm. He had done Goodbye Columbus. He had done a couple of very well respected performances and was definitely on the way up. Right. And it seems like, oh, Diane Cannon.
Diane Cannon.
Yes.
Who
when you have Raquel Welch in your cast,
yes,
and she's the second most attractive woman, I always had a crush on Diane Cannon. And she sort of dialed it down for this movie. I mean, I think it was...
Yeah, well, I think part of it is her character is her character's an agent.
Right, she's not an act. She's not a flamboyant. Well, this character is very flamboyant, right. But she's not the actress. That's Raquel Welch's part.
Right,
and she is as glamorous as you want Raquel Welch to be.
Right,
Diane Cannon is not in this movie, but she could hold her own with Raquel Welch.
Diane Cannon's kind of the comic relief character.
In a way, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She's funny in the movie. And it is a funny movie in general. It's a movie that stays fairly lighthearted, mm-hmm. despite the stakes of it all.
Yes.
So you have Coburn's character brings them all out to this yacht. They have to do this mystery, and they're celebrating. It's the one-year anniversary of the death of his wife, Sheila.
Celebrating, perhaps the wrong word.
Right. So, yes. Yeah.
Recognizing.
Recognizing. Yes. And everybody here, except for Richard Benjamin's wife, who's Joan Hackett,
mm-hmm.
Everybody here was there that night.
At a party.
At a party, yeah. When Sheila was killed by a hit-and-run driver. And they... the thing that intrigues me now watching it, even before the murder happens, it's already intriguing because you have Raquel Welch's character, who's named Alice, the actress. She catches on that basically in this game, they're all assigned different roles. One is you're a homosexual, one is you're a shoplifter.
Little secrets
that you have to keep to yourself. And she notices that, like, she starts to believe that all of the cards apply to actual people there, even if they haven't been assigned.
Right. I might have a card that says I'm the shoplifter, but one of the other people in the group was actually a shoplifter.
Right. And so before we've gotten to the murder, there's already mystery and there's already confusion.
Yes.
There's already a sense of something is off here. You already have one of my favorite movie tropes from these types of films where Raquel Welch is talking off camera or almost directly at camera to an unnamed character or an unknown character.
You don't know who it is.
We don't know who it is. We know it's one of the people, and she reveals that whoever she's talking to is the homosexual. It's my favorite trope because coincidentally, luckily, that person never talks. It's always the person she's talking to the camera. Whoever she's talking to is just not responding to everything.
What an amazing coincidence.
Right. A perfect coincidence for the audience. But I love that. I love that trope.
By the way, again, product of its time in 1973 when the movie came out, hiding the fact that you were a homosexual was a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. Especially in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially. And as we later find out, this character is not maybe homosexual. They just have a past.
Had a little fling.
They had a fling. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I love that establishment. And there's something here I need you to help me with.
Uh-oh.
I don't fully understand how... Because I watched it today. I read the Wikipedia summary afterwards. I get everything about the central mystery and what happened. I don't fully understand how the game is won each night. Because the point is, like, each day he says, okay, today you're finding the shoplifter, right? And then I don't understand how they find out who is.
It's a delightful thing creating a fictional script of a puzzle game.
Right.
Because usual... And I've played a few scavenger hunts.
Yeah.
If you just have this, like, one obscure clue, like in the first game that they played, everybody got a key.
Mm.
And you had to figure out what that key was for. Well, if that's all you've got to go on, you're not going to get very far.
Yeah.
Games like this work better when there are puzzles to solve. Mm-hmm. And maybe it takes you longer to solve, like a crossword puzzle or something. Or a word search. Something that you have to do, and it might take you longer than it takes the other person. But you keep doing it till you got it done.
Yeah.
These random little clue things are tricky. But of course, in a scripted mystery, you can pull it off. The way this game was played is that... So we keep using the shoplifter because that was the first game.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all looking for the shoplifter. We're all looking for the clue to find out the identity of the shoplifter, who is one of the six people.
Yeah.
The idea is... everybody goes and tries to solve this mystery using, in this case, it was the lock, the key that they had. And you win that round if you figure it out before the shoplifter does.
Mm-hmm.
Once the person who actually had the shoplifter card solves the mystery, then no one else gets points for that round.
Right.
You're just trying to beat the one whose card it is in order to score a point. Is that, does that answer your question?
That answers my question. So I'm saying that, so basically it's not like a series of clues that lead you to the person. It's just one thing you need to find.
Right. This was, yeah, again, this is not the way a normal game would play.
Sure. Right.
Because for one thing, unless you're talking about people who are just deeply, deeply, deeply into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, in, even in the movie, you get some of them that just don't care. And right. they're just sitting in the bar somewhere waiting for it to be over.
Yeah.
But no, it was not a beautifully constructed game.
Right.
Because it didn't have to be. It was romantic
it's
fiction.
It's a back story.
Right. That's just driving the story forward.
Right.
I mean, because it's scripted, when you see the connection that they make, you go, oh, that's really clever.
Yeah.
But how would you possibly have made that connection?
Right, right.
It just, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Luckily, that's not the main mystery.
Right, right. In fact, you know, I think the first hour of the movie is the weaker hour. I mean, you've got some fun lines and you've got a fun setup.
Right.
But it doesn't really get interesting to me until they're all back on the yacht after... Right. James Coburn's character has been killed.
Yeah.
And let's just say they start to lay out what might have happened.
Yeah.
I think that sequence, which is long.
Yeah.
It's a very long scene where, and you get flashbacks and you get other things happening, but that is what drags me. That's what pulls me into the movie every time.
Yeah.
Is when they start figuring out how he could have been actually killed.
Yeah.
Luckily, the game, they only play two of these little games, and neither of them are very good.
Right.
But that's the way it worked. The idea is you would score a point if you could get there before the person whose card it was.
So I'm glad you brought up that shift, because it genuinely is that part after they reconvene on the boat, after they realize there's been a murder, where the movie kicks in high gear, and essentially... It's two scenes. The rest of the movie are two scenes.
You're right. It really is. It really is just two long expository.
Yes. Yeah.
You would think, how boring is that?
Right.
But they're fat. They're just amazing scenes.
Well, it's riveting because you have a bunch of great actors who know how to sell it. You have, I think that it's directed in a way that really takes advantage of. We have five actors in the same room. Nowadays, it's like so many movies are. So clearly cut and paste of we could only get this guy this day or whatever. It's like, no, we have everybody in the same room and they're all talking. And we also, I love in the editing, this Rashomon, like these cutaways to each person's version of what might've happened.
Like I said earlier, there's tons of flashbacks.
Yeah.
But the flashbacks aren't necessarily things we've already seen. And the flashbacks are always exactly what the teller is telling us.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes around a second time and someone else is telling the story, then that's what it looks like.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that. And it is like, it takes such incredible writing to say, we're just going to put, you know, six people in a room and have them talk about something and it's going to be riveting. And in the movie also, like throughout that scene, it reveals just enough information at the right time where we feel like we're actually going forward. You know, it doesn't have that like, oh, we're just stalling. People are arguing.
Nah.
They're constantly moving forward. And one thing I really like about it is since everybody's a Hollywood person, everyone is to some extent a little vapid and selfish. They're not too broken up about the murder.
No, they're not at all. That's right. One of the fun things about this. One of the things I don't think we pointed out was that we mentioned that James Coburn's character is the producer who's wildly successful.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else, the six people that he brings onto the yacht, have reason to need him.
Yes.
They are all in various stages of their careers and could benefit greatly
mm-hmm.
by getting in his good graces, some more than others. Some are a little more desperate than others, but they all... basically need to kiss up to him because he's horrible to all of them.
Right.
Because
right.
he can be.
Yeah.
It's just a, a revolting character, except that he makes it fun.
He makes it fun. And James Coburn's the perfect actor for this because he has this giant toothy grin that he gives, you know.
Everything's a joke to him.
Everything's
to the,
funny.
To the character. And it plays well that way.
And he has a God complex.
Oh,
and,
gosh, yes.
And for a majority of the movie, we're led to believe that he is actually playing a sick game with these people. Which is
true.
Not quite as sick as it turns out to be, but we for a portion of the movie we're like, oh, he's really on a vendetta. There's something serious happening here.
Yes. We are now skirting an issue.
We're now skirting an issue. So I guess I will give the listeners at home a warning. We're gonna have to talk about the denouement of the story and all the things that come with it. So go watch Last of Sheila.
Yeah.
It has a glowing recommendation from both of us.
Absolutely.
And if our recommendation isn't enough, Edgar Wright sings this movie's praises. Rian Johnson credits it with being a huge influence on Knives Out and Glass Onion, to the point that Glass Onion has a cameo from Stephen Sondheim.
And has that beautiful Mediterranean vibe to it.
Right.
You know, and the one godlike jerk sort of pulling everybody's strings. I mean, it's very, very much.
Down to the first act being them all individually getting their invitations.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I have to say, one of the things that I just love, this amuses me greatly, which I noticed when I pulled my DVD out of my case. You know, I have many fewer movies than you do.
Mm-hmm.
Alphabetically, side by side, next to The Last of Sheila, just in front of it, is Knives Out.
Oh, no kidding.
K-N-L-A, they're right beside each other.
Oh, that's fun.
I just thought that was really cute.
I'm sure
not intentional in any way whatsoever. As much as Johnson has said, he was influenced by The Last of Sheila.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's just a crazy coincidence.
So you own Knives Out?
I own Knives Out, well. Yes.
Are you generally a fan of the whodunit genre, or
generally, yes, okay. Generally so. Basically, I loved Last of Sheila so much.
Yeah.
I'm interested in other efforts like that.
Right.
I was not as huge a fan as everybody else was of the comedy Clue.
Oh yeah,
that did
yeah.
not resonate with me as well. Mostly because in the end, there's not a mystery there.
Right.
It's just all a big goof.
There's three different endings.
And for that matter, there's three different endings.
Yeah. That's one you just kind of have to laugh at Tim Curry or just enjoy.
Right, it's just funny.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the stage version that is adapted from, but it's still its own thing, is better.
Okay.
Or maybe I'm just ready for it to be that way.
Sure.
I enjoy the stage version a lot more than I did the movie.
Okay.
And as you said earlier, so many of these things, so many of these, you know, Agatha Christie movies that you would watch are based on a book, and
yeah.
you either follow the book or you disappoint the people who are going to see it because you followed. Wait, that's not how it ended.
Well,
that's a tough thing to pull off.
That's a really funny thing, just as a quick sidetrack. When I was first getting into whodunits and I was watching, I was just seeking out everything, and I was looking up, it was easy to just look up Agatha Christie adaptations, right? And so sometimes you'd have something that was great, like the Sidney Lumet Murder on the Orient Express
sure.
film with Albert Finney. Great movie. And then sometimes you'd stumble on, I remember I saw this god-awful adaptation of And Then There Were None, or the 12 Indians.
Ten Little Indians.
There was
an earlier title.
There was a different title.
More offensive.
We do not talk
we don't
about
go that. We don't go that far. Yeah.
But it was like awful. It had Donald Pleasance in it, and it was like a real B movie mm-hmm. from the time. But you know, I'm a kid.
You
I don't know
what
what's
you find,
good
yeah.
or what's bad.
I but, like the Branagh movies are good. They're fun.
Yeah, the Branagh movies are—they're fun. They're mm-hmm. a little goofy.
Yeah,
they're fun.
A little broad.
And the thing about Last of Sheila is this movie is airtight. Like it's not. None of my enjoyment of it is at all ironic. There's none of this like, oh, it's goofy fun.
The tone works for its time and in its structure.
Yes,
these guys knew what they were doing.
Right, and part of what makes it so enjoyable. It's not even, as I was mentioning before, it's not an issue with the movie that these characters are kind of having a good time mm-hmm. hashing out the mystery. They're hanging out and having drinks.
Yeah, you would think after their host was murdered,
right,
there would be a lot more official stuff happening.
Right.
But no, they're just enjoying their cruise and idly trying to figure this little this real mystery out.
Yeah, it's fun for them.
Yeah.
For them,
it
the
really
game
is.
The game is still continuing.
And it helped that he was not well-liked.
Right.
It wasn't, you know.
Well, and it's, you know, Perkins
who
and Sondheim.
Had a, who had a motive? Well, we all did.
We all had a motive, yeah, which is good. Yeah. And then Perkins and Sondheim also, tonally, they're smart enough to know that that helps us believe that these characters aren't going to be too broken up about it. They build that into the story so that we're like, okay, second half, we're just going to have fun. And so, yeah, I love this, you know, Richard Benjamin's character, Tom Parkman, he kind of comes to the forefront as the lead detective.
Right.
The guy who's kind of hashing out all the evidence. He's the one who pieces together, oh, all of these cards apply to us, which is one scene that very difficult to take lightly, all but outright says that James Mason's character is a pedophile.
Yes. Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a moment where he as an actor really sticks out because they're deducing, they're slowly moving down who's who. Ian McShane admits I'm an ex-convict. Mm-hmm. You know, all of this. I love when Diane Cannon admits she was a HUAC rat.
Yes.
You know?
And a very moving scene.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Sometimes they get work. Sometimes I get them work. You know,
right.
She's really regrets
she's
having been an informant.
Yeah, she's guilty about it. Yeah, yeah. And I like that moment. So it's like you learn a bit about each person where you're like, these are flawed people. Some of them are worse than others. Some of them aren't that bad, you know.
And they don't dwell on James Mason's indiscretions. Although I think it was cute that they had early in the film when they're establishing who everybody is, he's making a dog food commercial with a lot of little girls. That comes in, and you say, now, ooh.
Right? You think back on that,
but they sort of play it off lightly.
Yeah, and his performance is great because he starts just kind of babbling incoherently, where.
I love James Mason, and I love Richard Benjamin.
Yes.
I know Richard Benjamin from other things.
Yes.
Than Saturday the 14th.
I now know him from other things, but yeah, yeah.
And we talked about, we did My Favorite Year, didn't we?
Not on the podcast, no.
Oh, well, we have to do that at
next
some point.
Next year.
Because that's his directorial debut.
Right, yeah, okay.
So he's had quite the career. We were talking about alphabetical order billing. I think if this movie was billed according to importance,
mm-hmm.
it would be starring Richard Benjamin, James Mason, and James Coburn as...
Right, it would end with and James Coburn.
And James Coburn
He's
as.
Such an and billing
but because
character.
Really, in the second half, it's really the Richard Benjamin and James Mason show.
Yeah, they come to the forefront there where Richard Benjamin's leading this investigation. And I love the moment where... Yeah, when they narrow it down to, oh, obviously James Mason is the little child molester.
The little child
is
molester.
Is what's on the card. And he just starts babbling incoherently, and they go, and then Richard Benjamin kind of is like, you know what, maybe we should stop this.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Like, it's getting too real now.
I said I love James Mason. There's a specific thing, too. I get a vibe from James Mason. I may have spoken about this in other podcasts. But my uncle was an actor, lived in New York City, did mostly commercials, made his living doing commercials, but was on Broadway, had some successes, was in a Tony Perkins movie.
Oh.
Was in something called Pretty Poison.
Oh, wow.
Very small part in Pretty Poison. But anyway, my uncle, when I see James Mason, it reminds me of my uncle. My uncle always had that air of being sophisticated. For my uncle, it was mostly a put-on. He was not British at all. He was from southern Tennessee. He was from the mountains of East Tennessee.
Yeah.
He was a hillbilly, if you will. So it was very important to him as an actor to establish himself. You know, he could put on the southern accent if he needed to, and he did for certain roles. But he had that James Mason presence whenever I would see him. So when I see James Mason, especially in a role like this, it reminds me so much of my uncle.
Wow. Well, yeah. And particularly you're seeing him older, right? In this.
Oh, yes, so absolutely. I knew my uncle at that age.
Yeah.
That's the age I picture my uncle being.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I never knew that.
I also like that James Mason said in interviews that he approached the role as playing a washed-up James Mason.
Yeah.
That's what he was going for, is at that point in his career, a lot of people had forgotten he had ever been around.
Right.
And back in the day, you know, he had made A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
He had made the forget Lady Gaga and Cooper and all that business. He had made the definitive A Star Is Born with Judy Garland.
Judy Garland, yeah.
Yeah. And had made, you know, major 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
You know, he made some
He was a movie star.
He was a movie star.
Yeah.
And then for a long time he wasn't.
Right.
And he still had Heaven Can Wait and The Verdict ahead of him.
Right.
So it wasn't like he was completely off the radar.
But even then, he was graduating into this new type of actor, which is you're a respected actor, you're not a movie star anymore.
So the goal was in this role to play him as if he hadn't had the success that he ended up having.
That's an awfully vulnerable move to make as an actor, too.
It's very self-aware.
Yeah.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, you see a lot of actors that sometimes don't want to admit that they're at that point.
Yes.
You know, they live under, like, a false impression.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have morbidly obese Steven Seagal running around pretending he's still a Navy SEAL or something. But that self-awareness and to tap into probably what he has genuine feelings as being a quote-unquote washed-up actor, you know, and that, he's a director who, like you said, is directing commercials.
Yeah.
You know, in his old age. Yeah. And that's great. And so you even learn how even somebody maybe accomplished and older still depends on this James Coburn character.
Right.
You know, for
the idea, and it's not an important plot point at all, but the idea is that James Coburn character wants to make a movie version about his wife's life.
Right.
And about his wife's death.
Which isn't important to the plot, but is important thematically.
Okay.
And it does connect at the end. Is
true.
Something I really like about
true,
it.
Yes.
And that's what makes a perfect script, where it's not just about the plot, which is the mechanics and what's happening. It's about the story and kind of what it's saying about the characters and the process. And I love that the movie never gets too caught up being one or the other. You know, sometimes you watch a movie like this and it ends up being much more of a character study and you kind of lose interest in the plot. But then sometimes they're so plot driven, you wonder what was the point, what was the story trying to tell? And
within 10 minutes, we know who these characters are, and that's all we need.
Right. Gosh, I don't even know how to get into... I mean, essentially...
Well, maybe we don't really reveal all the twists and turns.
Yeah, we don't have to reveal all the twists and turns.
Let's say, as the plot progresses, that Richard Benjamin and James Mason have their moments, and again, it's the two of them at this point.
Yes.
And very clearly... the solution to the mystery is laid out. Everybody, everything's figured out.
Down to a confession.
Down to a confession. Everything's tidied up. Everything's perfect. And it's only 90 minutes in, and it's a two-hour movie.
Right.
And
this is the Columbo, but just
one more thing.
Just one more thing moment.
But it really is. That's the beauty of the script, is that you can look at that and say, well, okay. All of that makes perfect sense.
And I want to point out, this has one of my favorite moments where they had earlier on implied that Raquel Welch's character has been having an affair with Richard Benjamin's character. And the way that after this horrible tragedy happens at the end of the second act, I guess, she says to him, like, well, now that you're available, I'm just not interested anymore.
It's great.
But if you find another woman, you know, give me a call.
If you ever get married again, call me.
Which is especially so funny and nihilistic in a way, where it's like Raquel Welch has received a decent amount of, like, I don't want to say empathy, but pathos throughout the movie. You know, she's a fairly grounded character.
Yeah.
And then her final moment, she gives the most vapid, tone-deaf line. And you're like, oh, at the end of the day, she's an actress.
And she does say, isn't that awful of me?
Isn't that awful?
But that off she goes.
Right. Yeah, just goes off. And that's the last time we see her.
Relevant to nothing. Behind the scenes, apparently, she was a problem.
I heard about that.
That she was difficult. But, you know, she was a sexpot actress.
Yeah.
She had an image that she very carefully cultivated.
Yeah.
Just like the character... In the movie.
You're never going to get a cast with this many big actors and not have at least one that doesn't mix well.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it always happens, I feel like. But
so anyway, the everything gets solved.
Yeah. But something's and bothering
something,
James Mason.
And James Mason says, I don't know about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the final solve, which adds so many more twists and turns.
Yes.
But it all fits.
Yes.
And that's the beauty. And this is one of those great movies, great mysteries, where, you know, usually you think you see a mystery and you watch it once and, okay, that was really interesting. But I don't need to watch it again because I know how it ends.
Yeah.
Watching it again, and I hadn't watched it for easily more than a decade. I hadn't seen the movie until we watched it before we did this. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to turn up later. Oh, yeah, that's... this is fascinating because all these things that he explains at the very end happened.
Yeah.
And as watching it with fresh eyes, you know what's going to happen, but now you see the things happening.
Yes.
And you just marvel again at the intricacy of how everything fits together.
Yeah. And I love that even in the climax of the story where you have two characters and there's a confrontation happening.
Yes.
There's a what's bound to be a life or death situation happening. There's still this casual atmosphere of like, we're having drinks, we're walking around. I'm going to turn my back towards you as I'm as I'm talking about some things. And I love that.
Where I'm checking the door. Oh, the door's locked. Well, oh, that's not a good thing.
That's interesting.
But
that's
I don't know what to do about it.
Right, right. And that's a great source of like dry comedy in the scene that also at the end of the day, they're still acting. They're talking like a writer and a director to the point that... a huge part of the ending is that it's assumed they're...
So it's funny, but at the same time, it adds the tension.
Yes.
Because you know something's got to happen.
If this scene was simply two guys running around, one guy chasing the other guy, it would be Halloween. It would be a slasher movie. Yeah. You wouldn't have the that cleverness of the sort of the verbal cat and mouse chase between these characters, and one character kind of trying to... deflect, you know, trying to saying what's really interesting is that Richard Benjamin's character plays detective and he's the one leading the charge for so long, and I love the moment where he's just like, maybe we should stop, you know, and then where eventually James Mason, who's the little child molester, he comes to the forefront as the guy who really wants to see the rest of this mystery through to the end and takes the baton. And I love that turn that happens. There's so many clever shots. I love moments in movies where people realize something.
Yes.
And there's 100 of those.
And you got to think that's hard to play. I would imagine as an actor, that would be very hard to play.
Right. Because you have to...
That awakening, that awareness.
You have to pretend you're thinking of something you've never thought of before.
Yes. Yes.
And I love the moment where James Mason realizes that the ice pick is missing, where it's in the foreground Richard Benjamin using something else as an ice pick.
I think it's a bottle opener.
Yeah. And then in the background, you know, it's like this perfect deep focus shot where you see both. And in the background is James Mason coming to this realization. And little choices like that from a directorial standpoint, I really love, as opposed to, you know, if it was just cutting to that and then cutting back.
One of the really neat things about this being set on a yacht.
Mm-hmm.
Yacht, and even massively extravagant yachts like this one was, are small and contained. It's very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And I loved reading, I did not know this, I loved reading that they were originally going to shoot the thing on the yacht.
Yes.
That the movie was going to be shot on
the
yacht.
And a yacht sunk.
Well, the yacht sunk, and even when they tried to use a yacht, the yacht moves around a lot. You can't really shoot on a yacht.
Right.
Come on. So they built the yacht in the south of France on a set.
Yeah.
And there's still some gorgeous outdoor shots. And certainly a lot of scenes were clearly shot on the boat.
Yes.
But most of that claustrophobia was actually just a very tight set.
Right, right. Well, and at the end of the day, it's like, of course you have to shoot on a set.
You can't, yes.
I think it's crazy that they even thought about shooting.
I think you're right.
Yeah, besides the motion sickness. But, I mean, you think about how many guys are off camera.
Yes.
How many people you're fitting in there, you know. But it's a great, great sequence at the end. And I love that even at the end of the day, when it all concludes, at the end of the day, everything's just about the movies and it's about the money. The fact that their entire conversation is misconstrued as just pitching a film and arguing about how this Last of Sheila film should be made.
But for the character who is revealed to be the murderer, it's a fate worse than death.
Yes. Oh, yes. God, the final shot.
Yes.
Incredible. The way that everything that this character has worked for and has murdered for is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they're stuck in their shitty, shitty position for the rest of their life, or at least, you know, for the time being. And it's a perfect freeze frame ending. Not only
while we hear Bette Midler sing Friends.
Yes, beautiful. And then the cut to the
Friends.
How perfect
is that?
Yes.
How perfect is that?
Yeah. And I love that crux of the, it's all in this one picture they took.
Yes, yes.
It's such
you
a clever...
You figure it out if you're smart enough.
Yeah, if you notice acronyms early on in the film, you'll know most of what's happening by the beginning, which I really love. So, I guess, how many times have you rewatched this movie over the years?
Boy, I don't go back to see movies over and over and over. Less than a dozen times, I'm sure.
Do you think... in any of those times, do you ever pick up on new things as you're watching it?
Or? I think every single time.
Every single time.
Certainly when I saw it yesterday before we did this, I thought, oh, yeah, I don't remember having seen that before.
Okay.
It helped a little bit because I don't know that I had seen it since reading the Wikipedia plot explanation.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit there that, you know, it wasn't necessary to understand what was going on. But it did help me sort of, okay, yeah, that's why. For one thing, especially early on, the dialogue comes so fast, you're not picking up every line. And it's not quite understandable what some of these people are saying.
Yeah.
Not that you needed to understand every single word, but understanding what they're saying. For one thing, sometimes they're funnier lines when you realize what the what the lines are, what actually are. So I think, yeah, I think, and that's, again, as I've said before, the beauty of this mystery film is that it holds up under repeat viewing.
Yes.
And in some cases, many, many times.
It's the perfect example of a movie that respects the intelligence of his audience.
It really does.
It even though it doesn't... I mean, it's not too confusing. It's not unintentionally confusing. But it's also not dog-walking you through every single detail.
And, you know, you would have a better sense of the history of cinema than I would, but I think that was a thing in the 70s.
Yeah.
This was a disposable movie. This was, you wouldn't call it a B-picture anymore, but this was not meant to be Jaws.
Right.
You know, this was not meant to be a massive, massive, massive undertaking. And we don't make those movies anymore. We don't make these mid-sized movies anymore.
No.
Not nearly as much as we used to. But that was the through line, is that these would be adult movies.
Yeah.
And that's something that's lacking now.
The market in films for adults is, I mean, sometimes they, you know, they'll get squeaked out on streaming or something like that. And a lot of them go unseen because
and thank goodness for streaming, because I think you're right. I think a lot of adult movies,
right,
that's the audience now.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I say adult, I it would be very unlikely to me that this would be R-rated.
It's a PG movie.
It's a PG movie.
Yeah.
But kids would, it's not.
Right, it's not for kids.
It's not for kids.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just not.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of movie we don't make as much anymore.
No, yeah, you're completely right. With certain exceptions, I think if you're a certain filmmaker, you're able to get some of these things made now.
True.
But yeah, you think about the last movie that had this many like adult movie stars in it or big actors. It's usually a Marvel movie.
Exactly.
You know, and once again, like I said before, nobody's shooting on the same day. It's always you know, green screens and different cities and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is. It's a relic. It's it is the perfect idea of what is a great whodunit film that's not ironic. It's not a parody, you know. It's not a comedy, but it's funny.
Oh, it's very funny. It is a dark comedy, as they say.
It's sort of a dark comedy, which I think is that's part of Anthony Perkins as a filmmaker, who I know he didn't have a huge career behind the camera,
right?
I think that was a bit of his MO because he infamously directed Psycho 3.
I knew he did one of them. I didn't know which one it was.
He directed that one, and he's kind of known for the fact that he's put a lot of macabre humor into that.
Okay.
Because he was really into the films of the Coen brothers at the time and things like that, like Blood Simple. And so I can see his, you know, his fingerprints on the script in that way. And then I guess you can see Stephen Sondheim's fingerprints in terms of just how complex everything is. And does he have any other credits as a screenwriter?
I don't think so, unless he's credited here and there for something like an adaptation of one of his musicals.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he's got any standalone movies like this in his resume.
And that's part of just
as colorful as his resume has been.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, yeah, nobody, when people talk about Stephen Sondheim, nobody's talking about The Last of Sheila, and it's not because of it's not a detriment to this movie. It's just because of how accomplished,
how much else he's done. Yes,
the rest of his career was. Yeah. But I guess, I mean, at the end of the day, this was a movie you recommended to me. Are you still regularly throwing this out? Do you recommend this to any other students? I'm wondering, because you're still at the high school.
High school for a little while longer. I don't have students now that are into movies as much as you are.
Okay.
But it is a film I recommend routinely because it's something that people generally haven't heard of.
Yeah.
I love being able to recommend a movie that you say, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
I say, well, do you like mysteries? Well, then this is it. This is the mystery to recommend to people who like mysteries.
Yeah, that's well said, and it's as great as the directing is by Herbert Ross, because I do think he does bring a lot, and there are those stylistic flourishes I like in the final moments, which is funny. There's a use of hand puppets in the final moments that I really love. It's just such a fun gag thrown in. But then there's like this use of a fishbowl lens to make it kind of more intense the moment after that. And so I do love his direction. But at the end of the day, I'm like, if I was using this movie to teach something, I would use it to teach screenwriting, which is very funny considering that these are two guys not known as screenwriters
at all.
And it's such a tight film. Everything that's ever shown to you means something. Even in that first half, which you admitted is, you know, the slower half, you go back and watch it. It's so meticulous. Every single little thing they give you.
Yeah.
Every down to little lines, like, you know, Diane Cannon, some of her rambling could be seen as comical, and it's just supposed to be comic relief. But some of the stuff she's saying pays off later.
Yeah.
You know, it's every little detail matters, which I love. And then, also, yeah, this greater kind of statement about the about Hollywood and the types of people that are there, and they're all, even the good guys of this movie are not good guys.
Oh, nobody's.
There's no heroes.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah. So I do like that a lot. I wanted to mention, I per usual, I tried to look up half star reviews for the movie on Letterboxd.
Okay.
I think a lot of these project more negatively on the person writing them than
that
the
sounds like fun.
Movie itself. Half a star, an influential yet wasted potential mystery film. Premise is far too contrived and unrealistic. Mystery plot is fairly shallow. Story flow and characters are pretty clear, and pacing is energetic. Third act twists and reveals are very cheap and obvious, even to the point of altering scenes and flashback. I think that's really funny because that shows a lack of media literacy, I think.
We just talked about you're not seeing it exactly the same way.
Right,
and
seeing...
like you said, that goes back to Rashomon.
Exactly, Rashomon. Mm-hmm. Study Kurosawa, my guy. Has a huge number of plot holes and conveniences that consistently demonstrates the film's poorly written story. I don't know what to say besides, like, you need to... this is one where I'm like, I think this... because the movie makes perfect sense if you really do think about it. I think you should probably watch it again.
I mean, you know, it's heightened. It's not a documentary, for heaven's sake.
Right.
It's a movie.
Unrealistic is very funny. Yeah. This is my favorite one. It's just one word. Puppets with a question mark.
Yes, puppets.
Yeah. And then this movie... this movie is actually pretty stellar and has a really solid mystery in it, but I'm legally bound to give it one star because it may have been responsible for inventing POV ASMR videos.
Oh my.
Which I think is entirely due to the scene where Raquel Welch talks to the screen.
I guess. Boy, that takes a leap of logic.
It does.
That's marvelous.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, nobody really has anything concrete to throw at this movie, the lesson.
It's marvelous.
Before we go, is there anything else you want to say about Last of Sheila?
No, but I do want to say, because of my... I guess, you know, fame, I don't know, whatever word you want to
use. Yeah.
I get to do podcasts fairly routinely.
Okay.
I always love coming back to here.
Thank you.
This is John, it's so much fun to just sit and talk about a movie with you.
That means a lot. I love that. Well, and was We Are Movies, was this your first podcast you were ever on?
I'm pretty sure it would have been.
Wow.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I always
come back
to home.
To my first. You never forget your first.
You never do. Yeah. How many, out of curiosity, what other podcasts have you been
on? A lot of game show stuff.
Oh, sure.
A lot of game show stuff. I did one for an organization in Lansing. that, well, again, game show, they were interested in Quizbusters. Just, you know, a variety of things.
Yeah, well, Matt Oninger, the game show expert, is very well documented for good reason. I'm happy to be the only one holding the bucket for Matt Oninger, the part-time cinephile.
This is true. You know? I might have talked Star Trek. I can't remember if I specifically did a Star Trek 2 podcast or not, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Our first episode was
Star Trek. That was us. Yes, we did. We did.
Oh, but you're saying you might have done.
There might have been somebody else.
Somebody else's Star Trek.
I'd have to remember.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, I guess speaking of your life outside of this, do you, and speaking of your fame, your notoriety, locally.
Notoriety is a better word.
Notoriety. Like, yes. We'll say that. Do you have anything to plug? Anything you want to call people's attention to?
Completely outside of the movie stuff, but my big project lately has been working on a crazy detailed, as we talked about before, look at the old panel show called I've Got a Secret.
Mm-hmm.
It ran from 1952 to 1967 in its original form and several versions since then. I have the ultimate viewer's guide, if you will. Tons of these episodes are available on YouTube, and if you want to read more about the people who were on the show and the people who did this or did that or did the other thing, you can go to my website, which is ivegotasecret.website.
Wow.
And read all about this panel show.
So real quick about that, why I've Got a Secret? Why was this the show that you zeroed in on to cover?
Several reasons. One, Bill Cullen was on the panel, and I'm a huge Bill Cullen fan. BillCullen.net is the other website that I share with Adam Neediff, who literally wrote the book about Bill Cullen. It's also... The thing about I've Got a Secret, it was much more about the popular culture of the time. The game was incidental, and in fact, I don't dwell on the game at all. It doesn't matter to me whether the panel was able to figure out that this woman had got hit by a meteorite or that this guy can play four trumpets at the same time.
Yeah,
that wasn't interesting. What was interesting is that the thing about the woman getting hit by a meteorite was a major news story at the time. And nobody remembers today.
Right.
There was a family in South Carolina that got that had an atomic bomb hit their house.
Yeah.
Now it didn't have its warhead.
Sure.
But this happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of sillier stuff too. And all of that is just fascinating to me. That period of history, that individual little stories like that are kind of lost now. The greatest website in the world to me is newspapers.com, because all of this it's hundreds of daily newspapers scanned and searchable, and you just find the most fascinating things.
You can see what was the top story on March 1st of 1948. Right.
And the beauty of doing this project has been these people who were on the show on I've Got a Secret. Yeah. We're there usually because their story, whatever interesting thing had happened to them, was in the newspaper.
Yeah.
And a producer in New York saw this in the newspaper and would call them up and say, hey, come tell your story on I've Got a Secret. That's it was so much cool. More a talk show, even a variety show, than it was a game show.
Yeah.
And going back and finding those stories and finding out little things that maybe they didn't talk about on the TV show, but still were very interesting to me. That's why I call it, as opposed to an episode guide, it's a viewer's guide.
Yeah.
Watch an episode, and if that looked interesting to you, you can find out more about it when you go to my website.
That's a great point, and that's kind of applies to what gets me interested in so many old things, old films and shows and things like that, is that indirectly you're also documenting history. You know, by documenting I've Got a Secret, you're also documenting the stories that come with it.
That is exactly my point. It is much more about the popular culture of the day and the history of the day than it was ever about the game. The game is virtually identical to a far more famous show called What's My Line?
Mm.
But on that show, they were just guessing people's jobs. That's all it was. There are historical footnotes you could make with some of those episodes. But I've Got a Secret, three shows a day were interesting things about what was happening at the time.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming back all these years later, every year. I'm looking forward to the next anniversary, the sixth anniversary, which we'll find out a couple weeks before then what that movie will be.
We still have several in the back of my head.
There's a lot more in the chamber. There's other great Richard Benjamin films that we can cover.
I would love to talk about my favorite year.
Yeah, we
did
that.
The Stuntman, which is my favorite movie about making movies.
Yes.
My favorite year is my favorite movie about making television shows.
Okay.
And they both have Peter O'Toole.
And you had mentioned that, and the funny thing I have to tell you is at the end of the day, you always talk about how you are less of a cinephile than I am. More often than not, you introduce me to some of the most interesting movies I've seen. The Stuntman is one of the most bizarre and different films I've ever seen.
It's great.
And I loved it.
Yes.
And Last of Sheila is another one of those that's just like, if anybody asks me, what is just a perfect whodunit, I'll point them here. And also just like a great underrated, genre film for adults.
People don't know about.
Yes,
that's
great.
The best thing to recommend.
So I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to next year.
Thank you,
always.
John. I appreciate that. But you got to have friends.